For What's Universal Time, stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. Turkey has continued a post-coup attempt crackdown, dismissing hundreds of military personnel, shutting down dozens of media outlets. Arrest warrants have been issued for scores of journalists. U.S. spokesman John Kirby Wednesday said such moves represent a troubling trend.
What we've been very consistent on is condemning the attempt by military force to overthrow a democratically elected government. And we've also, in conversations with Turkish authorities at various levels, urged restraint, a dedication to the rule of law, and the democratic principles that have upheld the elected government in Turkey already.
But Atlantic Council analyst Aaron Stein said the crackdown has wide support among those backing the government of President Recep Tayyip Erdogan.
I do think that the government believes that now is their time, is that they have political support for this. The Gulenists are considered to be the number one threat to Turkey, and so that now is the time to eradicate their influence within the Turkish bureaucracy completely. Otherwise, you risk losing the coalition supporting you domestically.
Tens of thousands of military, police, academics, judges, and civil servants have been fired, suspended, detained, or questioned for alleged links to exiled Muslim cleric Fethullah Gulen. Zimbabwe's 92-year-old President Robert Mugabe, addressing thousands of supporters Wednesday, dismissed demands from war veterans that he step down.
If I still have the energy and still have the life and the blessings of God, I'll continue.
Last week, members of the Zimbabwe National Liberation War Veterans Association charged Mr. Mugabe of having devoured the values of the liberation struggle against white minority rule. The Zimbabwean leader accused them of colluding with secret agents from abroad. This is VOA News. At least 44 people were killed, dozens wounded, in a suicide truck bombing in the predominantly Kurdish northeastern city of Qamishli. The Islamic State claimed responsibility for Wednesday's blast, calling it a response to what it called crimes committed by the Crusader Coalition aircraft in the IS-held town of Manbij under siege by U.S.-backed Kurdish and Arab forces. In Iraq, a mortar attack targeting a camp for displaced people south of Baghdad Wednesday killed at least four, and a suicide bomber detonated explosives after a policeman tried to stop him from entering a crowded marketplace in a Shia neighborhood, Shula, in the capital, Baghdad, killing at least one policeman. A day after nominating Hillary Clinton as its 2016 presidential nominee, the Democratic Party late Wednesday heard President Obama call Clinton uniquely qualified to succeed him as president in January.
And no matter how daunting the odds, no matter how much people try to knock her down, she never, ever quits. That is the Hillary I know. That's the Hillary I've come to admire.
Speaking to the party's convention in Philadelphia, Mr. Obama said his former Secretary of State has been with him, helping him make difficult decisions as chief executive and commander-in-chief. Democrats also heard from Vice President Joe Biden and Virginia's Senator Tim Kaine, Clinton's running mate, who was officially nominated as the party's vice presidential choice. Clinton delivers her acceptance speech late Thursday. John Hinckley, the man who attempted to assassinate President Ronald Reagan 35 years ago, is to be released from a government psychiatric hospital in Washington. A federal judge said the 61-year-old Hinckley is no longer a threat to himself or others and will be allowed to live with his mother in Williamsburg, Virginia, as early as August 5th. Former Secret Service agent Danny Spriggs expressed disappointment at the decision.
What kind of message does that send to potential individuals who are in a similar either mental state or situation where they basically are looking for notoriety? And that does concern me.
Hinckley has been confined to the psychiatric hospital, allowed extended monthly supervised visits at his mother's home. In addition to wounding Mr. Reagan, Hinckley shot his press secretary, James Brady, a U.S. Secret Service agent, and a local policeman. Morocco Wednesday announced the arrest of dozens of suspects allegedly planning to set up an Islamic State affiliate in the North African country. The government said the arrests announced Wednesday were held July 19, interrupting plans to attack various sites, including music festivals. The U.N.'s humanitarian chief, Stephen O'Brien, warned Wednesday of an unfolding catastrophe in Nigeria and Lake Chad region caused by the Boko Haram insurgency, with nearly 3 million displaced by violence. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bate in Washington. Today is Thursday, July 28th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. A veteran Congolese opposition leader returns home after nearly 2 years abroad.
We have such a mass of humanity in the airport and everywhere in the road. I can tell you more than 2 million people today in the road of Kinshasa to see Mr. Tshisekedi.
Martin Fayulu is the leader of the Commitment for Citizenship and Development Party in the DRC. Ballot papers for Zambia's August 11th presidential election arrived today, Thursday. A new report said human rights in Sudan improved very little last year, and President Robert Mugabe again warned some Western governments to stop meddling in Zimbabwe's internal affairs.
Foreign embassies in the country that are interfering with our politics, although they're doing it privately, clandestinely, I want to warn them to desist from it.
And bacterial meningitis is linked to sandstorms in the Sahel. Those stories, plus our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. A Congolese opposition leader says President Joseph Kabila must respect the constitution, hold elections, and step down when his second term expires at the end of this year. Martin Fayulu, the leader of the Commitment for Citizenship and Development Party, says the opposition will not participate in any dialogue with President Kabila, sponsored by the African Union, because the facilitator, former Togolese Prime Minister Idem Kodjo, is biased. Instead, Fayulu says the opposition will participate in dialogue guarded by UN Security Council Resolution 2277, which calls for discussion that respects the Congolese constitution. Mr. Fayulu was reacting to the return Wednesday to the DRC of 83-year-old veteran opposition leader Etienne Tshisekedi. He says Mr. Tshisekedi was welcomed by more than 2 million Congolese.
Mr. Tshisekedi came with his wife, and you have such a mass of humanity in the airport and everywhere in the road. I can tell you more than 2 million people today in the road of Kinshasa to see Mr. Tshisekedi.
You talk about a mass of humanity, the people of the Democratic Republic of Congo. Do you think that they have hope in Mr. Tshisekedi?
Tshisekedi means the opposition, and Tshisekedi has resembled the opposition. And to see Tshisekedi with the old opposition and the people of Congo, they're happy for them to see the change in this country. As the Rassemblement said, the only thing we want to do is to respect the constitution. That, I think, the people of Congo, what they want.
Respecting the constitution means having elections. Are you hopeful that President Joseph Kabila will hold elections?
He has to do the election because he is required by the constitution. The constitution said that the president is elected for 5 years, renewal once. The Article 69 of our constitution said that the president is the one who should protect the constitution. And the president should ensure that all institutions can function normally. Functioning normally for the institution of the country means also that the Electoral Commission has to end the election because the act for the presidential election 90 days before the end of the current presidency. That means we should have election. There is no space for not having election. And if there is no election, that means someone has to be blamed.
The government says that budgetary constraints may make it difficult for the president to have the election the time you want him to have it.
That's the false reason. They cannot say that because they have done many things without respecting the budget. You know, since 2012, the parliament is putting aside every year $250 million for the election. And for this year, 2016, we have voted close to $600 million. Where is that money?
Mr. Fayulu, the African Union is trying to put together a dialogue between the opposition and President Kabila's government. Mr. Tshisekedi has come out against that dialogue. Are you, the opposition, willing to dialogue with the government?
No. We said in Brussels on the 10th of June, we will not participate in the Mr. Kabila dialogue. We'll participate in discussions according to UN Security Council Resolution 2277, because that resolution, it says that Congolese have to meet to discuss in order to organize the elections according to their constitution. That's what we want.
Martin Fayulu is the leader of the Commitment for Citizenship and Development Party in the DRC. He was speaking with me from the capital, Kinshasa. There were some powerful speakers at the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia last night, including current U.S. Vice President Joe Biden, Hillary Clinton's vice presidential nominee Tim Kaine, Mayor Michael Bloomberg of New York City, and above all, President Barack Obama. Joining us again from Philadelphia is VOA's Vincent Mankori, who is covering the convention. Good morning to you, Vincent.
Good morning, James.
Well, thank you again for joining us. Let's begin with President Barack Obama's speech. What did he have to tell the delegates?
You know, President Obama sought to portray a very, very positive image of the United States, especially under his presidency. He went back to tell the delegates that, you know, the last 8 years have been great years in this country. There's been a lot of achievement on all fronts. And he did acknowledge that not everybody may be necessarily completely satisfied as far as their individual needs are concerned, as far as their aspirations are concerned. But he mentioned the economic achievements. He mentioned the health care. He mentioned the justice against or for the terrorist Osama bin Laden, trying to do everything to kind of show people that the Democratic presidency under him has been a great success, whether it was the deal with Iran, whether it was, you know, the issues of security locally and internationally. So that, by extension, is telling the delegates and the Americans that, you know, Hillary Clinton's presidency will be a continuation of what has been a great successful 8 years of a democratic rule.
And, of course, former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton's vice presidential nominee, Tim Kaine, also spoke. What did he have to say?
You know, Tim Kaine first introduced himself to Americans. It's the first big forum after being appointed by Hillary Clinton to be a running mate. So he sought to explain who he is, where he came from, his leadership qualities, having been from mayor of Richmond to becoming a governor of Virginia. But also it was important he took that chance also to kind of, hit back at Donald Trump and to remind people that is according to him that you cannot believe a word that comes out of the mouth of Donald Trump. And, of course, extolled all the virtues of Hillary Clinton and made a case for why Hillary Clinton should become the next president and why he himself will be, you know, the better person to be a running mate with Hillary Clinton.
New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg, I would say, listening to him on television, deliver kind of a stinging critique of Republican Party nominee Donald Trump.
Yep. First, very remarkably, this is a person who is not affiliated to any of the political parties. He came and clearly stated that he's neither on the Democratic Party side nor on the Republican Party side, but as an independent, this time around, he has assessed everything and concluded that Hillary Clinton is the best person to be president of the United States. He talked about Donald Trump in very interesting terms. For example, he said he's a New Yorker, and you know Donald Trump is also a New Yorker, but he said he, as a New Yorker, he knows how to tell a con man when he sees him. He described Donald Trump as a con man. He talked about his business practices, his lies about his investments, and he went on to talk about the contrast between, you know, what you think of him as a great business person and what is the reality about his own life. So he really delivered a powerful blow against Donald Trump, a man that he knows so well because they have existed within the same city for a long time. They're both businessmen. But he made a difference. He said, look, I started my business not with a $1 million check that was handed over to me by my father in a way to show that, unlike Donald Trump, you know, he himself is a business person, but he has been a person who started from the bottom and has had to work with people in order to get where he is, whereas Donald Trump does not understand how to work with ordinary people. So what a blow. I can say a strong punch against Donald Trump that was delivered by former mayor of New York, Mayor Bloomberg.
Of course, Mr. Trump was in the news again Wednesday, particularly about the email scandal at the Democratic Party headquarters involving Russia.
You know, he never ceases to surprise people. Here he was saying, hey, Russia, if you are listening, I'll urge you to hack into Hillary Clinton's emails and release those 30,000 emails. Everybody's kind of confused as why would he say such a thing? Because he's been accused of, in fact, kind of admiring Vladimir Putin. But what he said, in essence, was to say he is happy with those, if possible, if true, the suspicion that the hacking of the emails was done by Russian agents. And by endorsing and encouraging Russians to do that, this is an American asking a foreign nation, and especially a nation that is not necessarily a great friend of America, to hack into a fellow American, a fellow presidential candidate, and in fact, you know, kind of encouraging cyber espionage against a fellow American. Really disturbing to many people. You know, they say he kind of goes overboard, and this is one clear issue where he went way beyond an appropriate level of even, you know, attack as far as you know, decorum is concerned. That's way beyond just a simple jab, you know, at somebody who you are fighting with or against for the presidency of this country.
Vincent, thank you very much once again for a very good coverage.
You're welcome. Thanks.
That was VOA's Vincent McCurry, who is covering the U.S. Democratic Party Convention in Philadelphia. The Electoral Commission of Zambia says printed ballots to be used in the August 11th general election and referendum will arrive in the capital, Lusaka. Today, Thursday, the electoral body awarded the contract to print the ballots to a Dubai-based printing company. Ruben Lefuka, former chairman of Transparency International in Zambia, tells reporter Peter Clarty that the Electoral Commission appears to have implemented measures to help ensure transparency during the printing of the ballot papers.
The printing of ballot papers has been a contentious issue. When the Electoral Commission of Zambia announced that they were going to use a Dubai-based printing company, however, in the run-up to the printing of the actual ballot papers, the ECZ has followed a similar practice that they've had in the last couple of elections, where they've allowed and paid for representatives of political parties, including civil society representatives, to witness the printing of the ballot papers. So that in itself has gone a long way to strengthen the confidence that people have in the manner that the ballot papers have been printed. So in general, there's a satisfaction that it's been a transparent process. There are still concerns as to how the papers will be stored and distributed thereafter. But in terms of this first phase, I think Electoral Commission of Zambia has managed to bring about a sense of transparency in the whole process.
Talking about transparency, are the political parties satisfied with the process so far of the printing of the ballot, because their representatives witnessed the printing?
Well, so far there's not been any adverse reaction to the printing, in that ECZ has kept everyone abreast. Of course, there's still lingering thoughts on how much it has cost to have the papers printed in Dubai. But we also need to understand that the process of selecting a printer went through a public procurement process. And the Zambia Public Procurement Authority did highlight how they arrived at a particular bidder. But generally, the concern for a number of Zambians is that we need to develop capacity locally to be able to print ballot papers. Because in the last couple of elections, we've opted to print ballot papers outside the country. when we can improve our own government printers and some of the local printers to be able to do this kind of work.
When the ballot papers arrive, the Electoral Commission officials are saying that all participating political party representatives will be present to take stock, and then will also monitor how it is distributed nationwide in readiness for the election. Does this bolster or make Zambians repose confidence in the Electoral Commission's ability to administer a credible vote on August 11?
Yes, I think generally Zambians have seen the progress that the Electoral Commission of Zambia has made over the years in the manner that they run elections. They've tried to the extent possible to make sure that this is a transparent election. The concern has always been in the way that votes are counted and the delays that accompany the counting of votes. There's also been concern about the transportation of ballot papers or votes that have been cast from far-flung areas, which cannot be accessed by road, but need to be accessed by air. And in most cases, Electoral Commission of Zambia has hired the Zambia Air Force. Now, the Air Force will only pick electoral officials and the ballot papers. They will not carry everyone on board. And that has always been a concern that that's a black spot. However, one is also bolstered in confidence in terms of the audit trail that is there, i.e. when the ballot papers arrive, people can count the ballot papers that have been received, and they can do so when they have monitors at the polling stations.
Ruben Lefuka is former chairman of Transparency International in Zambia. He spoke with reporter Peter Clotte from the capital, Lusaka. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, July 28th. Daybreak Africa time, 22 minutes past the hour. Zimbabwe President Robert Mugabe says he will remain in power despite growing calls for him to leave office for allegedly failing to effectively run the country. He made the remarks Wednesday at a meeting convened by war veterans and the ruling ZANU-PF party following a bold move by some former freedom fighters to part with the president ahead of the 2018 presidential election. Thomas Chiripasi attended the meeting at the ZANU-PF headquarters and filed this report.
Addressing some former freedom fighters belonging to a faction of the Zimbabwe Liberation War Veterans Association, President Mugabe said he would continue to occupy the country's top post for as long as Zimbabweans still wanted him to lead.
This is me, and you, my people will have me for yet some time. I say, I don't mind it.
The veteran leader accused Britain, France, and the United States of working with some war veterans and opposition forces through their embassies in Harare to effect what he described as illegal regime change. Some veterans of Zimbabwe's Liberation War aligned to Chris Muchangwa, who was recently expelled from ZANU-PF, last week called for Mr. Mugabe to leave office, saying he was too old to campaign for in the 2018 elections. Those war veterans also accused Mr. Mugabe of failing to run the country's affairs. The president dismissed these allegations.
Foreign embassies in the country that are interfering with our politics, although they're doing it privately, clandestinely, I want to warn them to desist from it. Their rules, the rules that govern them, don't allow them to interfere with our politics, to try to subvert our system of government, and to do things that amount to subverting the present government and its authority.
However, representatives of some foreign embassies told Studio 7 in recent weeks that they were not involved in Zimbabwe's political affairs, adding that they were only expecting the Harare government to uphold the rule of law and protect citizens' rights. Meanwhile, factionalism in the ruling party took another turn when Chimene openly castigated Vice President Emmerson Mnangagwa for allegedly keeping quiet when allegations of him plotting to remove President Robert Mugabe from power were being leveled against him by some in the ruling party. The vice president, who attended the meeting, did not say a single word, although Chimene challenged him to take on Mr. Mugabe at a special congress if he was power hungry. Mnangagwa reportedly leads a ZANU-PF faction that is angling to take over from President Mugabe once he leaves office, while First Lady Grace Mugabe is allegedly leading another faction calling itself Generation 40 or G40. Reporting from Harare, this is Thomas Chiripasi.
The British government says human rights in Sudan improved very little last year, despite the launch of President Omar al-Bashir's national dialogue and announcements of ceasefires between the government and rebels fighting in three areas of the country. Nabil Biagio of VOA South Sudan in Focus program reports from Khartoum.
In its 2015 Human Rights Priority Country report released last week, the British government says international humanitarian law violations and human rights abuses occurred in Darfur, South Kordofan, and Blue Nile, the majority of which were carried out by the government of Sudan. Khartoum-based human rights lawyer Saleh Mahmoud says not only was there little improvement, but conditions in Sudan actually deteriorated in 2015.
The situation of human rights in 2015 and 16 is more worse even than the situation before 2-3 years ago, 5 years ago. It's bad. It's really deteriorating to the worst.
Mahmoud says 2015 was marked by events in Darfur's Jebel Marra, in which government planes bombed rebels loyal to Abdul Wahid Nur. The United Nations said more than 80,000 civilians were forcibly displaced during the bombings. And Mahmoud says even UNAMID was not able to help civilians.
Aerial bombardment is increasing, especially in Jebel Marra, which was the main cause of the huge displacement and the killings of the population. Again, the performance of the UNAMID is very much disappointing because even in their presence, violations continued and they couldn't intervene to protect their lives.
Mahmoud says human rights violations such as sexual violence and interference with humanitarian workers trying to reach conflict areas was on the rise in 2015. He says what makes matters worse is the fact that the government is not willing to prosecute war crimes committed by soldiers and militias loyal to President Omar al-Bashir.
Justice accountability is not there. This is one element that encourages potential perpetrators to continue committing crimes.
Sudanese government spokesperson Ahmed Bilal flatly denies the human rights abuse allegations against the government, but he agrees with the report's authors on one point.
I do agree with them that we are all working to end the conflict, Blue Nile and South Kordofan.
Bilal says his government is willing to end the wars in Sudan based on the terms of the roadmap agreement as presented by the African Union High-Level Implementation Panel. The roadmap calls for a cessation of hostilities and for the rebels to join Mr. Bashir's dialogue in Khartoum to resolve their outstanding issues.
We are quite ready to stop the war completely with all the guarantees that in the areas where there is conflict, there will be no war. We are waiting for them to sign the roadmap.
The rebels have refused to sign the agreement, accusing the mediation panel of being biased in favor of the government.
And that's it for this Thursday, July 28th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Butte in Washington saying, have a lovely day, Africa.
Next on Straight Talk Africa, political turmoil continues to destabilize the government in South Sudan. President Salva Kiir has sworn in Taban Dengai as the new first vice president. He replaces Riek Machar, whose whereabouts are unknown since he fled Juba 2 weeks ago following fighting between the two men's rival forces. An in-depth discussion on South Sudan on Straight Talk Africa, Wednesday at 18:30 UTC. Next on Let's Talk. Obsession in a relationship. What does it do? Help or hurt the relationship? Join host Sandy Shomari and his guests discussing obsession in a relationship. This lighthearted show covers topics of your interest Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 17:30 UTC, right here.